Hello, everyone. Welcome to a Friday fireside chat. My guest today is Anupam, or he calls himself Bapu, Jenna, who's a doctor with Harvard and a co-author of this truly terrific book called Random Acts of Medicine. For those of you who are new to our firesides, just be aware they are recorded so that we can play them back afterwards. So don't say anything you don't want your best friend, cousin, grandmother, or whoever to know about. So without further ado, welcome, welcome.
And those recommendations apply to me as well, I guess, right?
Of course, of course.
Good to know.
So what a super fascinating book just out this year. It's called, as I said, Random Acts of Medicine, The Hidden Forces That Sway Doctors, Impact Patients, and Shape Our Health. And the book does a fantastic job of kind of debunking a lot of our myths about, about our healthcare and what we need to know. And I thought maybe just first start and explain to folks the core, one of the core issues in the book, which is this notion of naturally occurring experiments as opposed to randomized controlled experiments.
Sure. So maybe I'll say the following. I'll say two things. One is that I think everybody would understand that chance has enormous impact on our life. And in a lot of cases, there's not much that we can learn from it. So for example, if you're walking outside and you get hit by a car, or a loved one gets hit by a car, that could be totally random. But there's no sort of policy prescription that might follow from that that says, well, I'm not going to walk outside anymore, right? It's just bad things can happen, good things can happen, but we don't really learn anything from that. Similarly, people might be diagnosed with cancer but have no risk factors. That might be something that's random. We might later learn that there is something that caused that, but at that point in time, there's nothing that we can know about it except say some things that these kind of things happen. But there are these other situations where random occurrences affect our life, where we can learn something about them. And this book is about health and medicine and that intersection with economics. And we talk about all these areas where randomness affects our lives and creates these naturally occurring experiments that we can learn something about. So that's sort of the central thesis behind the book. And there's all these examples of how this plays out, ranging from marathons to your age, to who happens to see you in the emergency room as your doctor. So all sorts of examples in the book.
I love that. I love that. And so it's the idea that, you know, there are randomly occurring things that have patterns to them, and therefore we can, you know, kind of learn from them. And you start the book off with this very interesting example of actually one of the very first randomized experiments, the study of cholera in London. And maybe walk us through what that I guess in that case, a doctor discovered when it was in the 1840s, something like that, right?
Yeah, this is when I was 6 years old. That was a long time ago. So the idea was the following, is that there was this epidemic of disease, a diarrheal illness that was affecting people in the UK. And the question was, what was causing it? And how would you figure that out? Now, if you look at people who were getting the diarrheal illness versus those who weren't, they were probably different in a lot of respects, access to healthcare, education, income, what we call confounders, things that might suggest that there's a causal link between your income and education and your disease. But if you look further, it says it's probably not that. It's probably where these individuals are living. And so the experiment that the physician John Snow sort of uncovered, or this is of course history, so the details are a little bit muddled, but the talking point I think that people in epidemiology will say is that there was a well or a series of wells that were contaminated. And when the handles to those wells were taken off and people no longer had access to the water, diarrheal illness fell. And that was sort of an etiologic basis for something inside the water being the causative agent behind the diarrheal illness. And that ultimately was identified to be an organism called Vibrio cholera. So we now know that that causes diarrheal illness, but this is sort of a natural experiment where there's one pump, the handle was taken off, another one where it wasn't, and then you see what unfolds.
That is so fascinating. So how did you come to write this book? I mean, how did you get so intrigued by these natural experiments?
So a little bit about from my background. So I'm a clinician. I work at Mass General Hospital in Boston, and I was also trained in economics. I did my PhD in economics and went to medical school actually at the University of Chicago. And economics, as maybe many of your listeners will be familiar with, this idea of natural experiments is quite common, and people think about that a lot in the field of economics. Less so common in medicine. And so I became interested early on of trying to apply those economic tools to questions that affect our health. And it's kind of interesting because health is something that matters to everybody, and it matters in a major way. Things like labor markets and educational investments, which are also very important to us and as a society, economists were thinking a lot about. But the application of natural experiments to medicine and health was something that just happened much, much later. And so that was the original impetus. I was also lucky to have some people that I learned from at the University of Chicago, like Steve Levitt, who wrote Freakonomics. And so, seeing the way that he and his colleagues thought about the world, not in health, sort of gave me that bug to try to apply those same types of tools, the interest in big data, the interest in sort of clever natural experiments, but applying it to medicine and our health.
I love that. And you've also got a podcast, is am I
I
correct?
do. It was, yeah, it's creatively titled Freakonomics MD. So it's,
That's great. So for those of you, when we're finished here, if you want to dig in more, there's a whole library of podcasts available on this topic. So one of the first examples that you use in the book talks about why is it that kids born in the summertime are more likely to get the flu? And when you first think about it, well, why would that make a difference, right? So, and you learned this painfully yourself, right?
Yeah, I did. Like a lot of my ideas, they come from something that I experienced, good or bad. So the story behind this study, and there's actually a follow-up study that just came out last week. So this is good timing for our conversation. I'll tell you a little bit about that as well. So the story is, we have two kids. One of them, our son, has an August birthday, and as is quite common for kids, you take them to the pediatrician around their birth month. So because he has an August birthday, I took him for his 3-year-old checkup in August for a well visit. And as I'm walking out of the door, the nurse says to me, "Come back in a few weeks, we'll have your son's flu shot ready." And the first thing I thought to myself was, wow, had my son been born just 2 or 3 weeks later, I would have gotten the flu shot in the office that day. And now, fast forward a few weeks, I'm trying to schedule a flu shot for him. It's really difficult to get it done at the pediatrician's office because the slots book up. Walgreens, CVS, pharmacies, they're not vaccinating 3-year-olds against the flu at that point in time. And so it was a big ordeal. It took me hours to figure it out, but ultimately I did get him vaccinated. But it occurred to me that that might be a big barrier. And so what we did is we just look at the data, and what you see is that kids who have birthdays in the summer, two things are true. Well, actually, four things are true. The first is that they tend to go see the doctor in the summer for their wellness check. Two is that they are less likely to get the flu shot because it's not available in the doctor's office when they happen to be there for their annual visit. Three is that they are then more likely to get the flu than kids who have fall birthdays, because the fall birthday kids, they show up for their wellness visit in the fall, the vaccine's available, they get it in the office. And then the fourth thing is that the kids with summer birthdays, not only are they more likely to get the flu, but their family members are then more likely to get the flu. So it tells you something about how a barrier to care, in this case, just going to your pediatrician when it's convenient to do so, could have an impact on the flu. So that's that finding. I'll pause for a moment to get your reaction, because we have another study that just came out which builds on that sort of natural experiment to answer a very different question about the flu.
Well, I thought among the things I thought were super interesting about that write-up was that the age connection to your birthday tends to erode as you get older. So that effect kind of wears off as the kids move into their teenage years. But also the effect on grandparents, I thought was really interesting. That that you tend to be more vulnerable if your kid has a, if your grandchild has a summer birthday, which I would never have thought of.
And as we were Rita, as we were writing the book, I mean, we had that finding in the study, And as we were writing the book and trying to think of stories to tell around the research, which is sometimes hard to do, it reminded me of this conversation that I had with a bank teller. We live in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and we used to live in Brookline. And we moved from Brookline to Wellesley a few years ago, and I was setting up a local bank. And I go to the bank, and I'm just chatting with the teller, and they're doing their intake forms, and they ask me what I do, and I say, well, I see patients at MGH. And he says to me, oh, well, my dad was just in the hospital. And this is an older gentleman who I was seeing, and his dad was like 93 years old. And he said to me, he told me what happened. He said, Grandpa lives with him, and so does the grandson. The grandson's friend, the grandson's like 3 years old, his friend came over for a play date and had a fever. But the other kid's parents they brought him over anyway. And the grandson got sick, and then grandpa got sick. So sick from flu, it turned out to be flu, so sick that he had a cardiac arrest at home, meaning his heart stopped because he couldn't breathe well enough and get enough oxygen to the heart. And he got transported to the hospital, was in the ICU and recovered, which is amazing for someone who's that old. So it turned out to be a good story and a good outcome in the end. But it reminded me of our study because the flu is infectious.
Absolutely, yeah. And you said there was a recent study that came out?
Yes, so this one is kind of cool. It uses the same idea. So there's no story behind this. A few months ago, actually a few years ago, I was in a Zoom faculty meeting, and our chair, whose name is Barbara McNeil, Barbara's asking me what I've been up to, and I said, "Well, Barbara, I just got back from CVS, and my arm is sore." And she said, "Well, why is it sore?" I said, "Well, I got a flu shot." And she asked me, "Why did you get a flu shot?" And I said, "Well, Barbara, my wife wanted me to get some Doritos at CVS, so I went there to get some Doritos." And I saw a sign to get the flu shot. Says, well, I'm here. I'm just going to get it now. And she said, no, Bob, I'm not worried about the Doritos. I'm worried about why did you get the flu shot in September? And her thinking was that September might be too early because flu tends to peak sometimes later, let's say December, January, can be even later. And she thought that September might be too early. And that raised a really interesting question because if you get vaccinated against the flu in September, might that be too early? If you get vaccinated in December or November, might that be too late because your immunity requires some time to build? Now, how would you study that? You might do a randomized trial where you take thousands of people and you randomize some of them to get the shot early in the season and some to get a little bit later, and then you measure their flu rates over the course of the season to figure out what's the optimal timing. That study doesn't exist. You could also just look at people who happen to get it early and get it late. Problem with that is that it's not happenstance. There's a reason people get it in September, and they might be more sort of health-minded, and that might affect their rates of getting the flu. So it's not causal. So we use the birthday example as sort of a way to get at this question. You look at kids who are vaccinated, and it turns out that kids who have September birthdays, they tend to get vaccinated in September. Kids who have November, December birthdays, they tend to get vaccinated a little bit later. And so the birth month randomizes a child to when they're going to get vaccinated. And what we find is that kids with October birth months have the lowest rate of influenza, and they're most likely to get their vaccine in October. So what that means is that October, at least for young kids, might be the optimal timing to get the flu shot.
That's super interesting. Wow. Huh. So, as we sort of work our way through the book, you talk about the Tom Brady and the idea of being redshirted, and that, this, and I guess one of the things throughout the whole book is really this notion of how cutoffs make such a big difference, in so many dimensions. And I really resonated to this chapter in which you argue that kids that are right close to the cutoff for, getting into a school or getting onto a sports team or whatever it is, tend to be at a disadvantage, especially the younger that they are. And I re really resonated with that because the cutoff for elementary school in the district that I raised our kids in was October 1st, and our daughter's birthday was September 24th. And we didn't think anything of it. But when you really reflect on it, that meant that for most of her developmental years, she was nearly a full year younger, than the oldest kids in the class, and definitely at least half a year younger than, the median. And definitely that had a big impact, which she has since overcome, and it's all been fine. But I think we often don't think enough about those random cutoffs and what they mean.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it matters for two reasons. One is it matters because of exactly what you outlined, that kids who are just below the age cutoff for school age entry are going to be the youngest kids in their class. And that might have effects on their life. And there's a lot of studies that actually look at what happens to kids who are relatively young for their age versus on the older side, or relatively young for their class versus on the older side for their class. And there are differences across their lifetimes in outcomes. And we found that kids who have August birthdays in states with a September 1 cutoff, which a lot of states have a September 1 cutoff, kids with August birthdays are about 30% more likely to be diagnosed and medically treated, meaning with a medication, for ADHD compared to kids with a September birthday. And the idea is that the August-born child is going to be young for their grade. And so if they are a little bit more inattentive, a little bit more easily distracted, the teacher, the counselor, ultimately the parents, ultimately a physician might pick up on that and say, gee, I wonder if this child might have ADHD. And it's not that. I mean, the child might, but it's probably not that. It's just that that child is young for their grade. And so it tells us something about how these cutoffs matter, but it also speaks to the subjectivity of certain medical diagnoses. When you go see a doctor, they make a diagnosis, and you kind of have to have faith in that diagnosis. And oftentimes, I think most of the time we should, but there are elements of subjectivity that come into certain diagnoses that don't come into other ones. So, for example, there is no August versus September difference for something like asthma or diabetes, because those are conditions that are very objectively measured based on blood tests or lung testing, that kind of thing.
That's super interesting. And so the Tom Brady solution, right, was he took himself out of contention for his college football team for a year.
Exactly. Look at how it turned out. Exactly.
it turned out really great. So what's the implication for parents? Should we be nervous about sending our kids to school if they're close to the cutoff? Should we hold them back a year? I mean, I know that's actually been something that has been done a lot with young boys, that you definitely see parents making the decision to hold them back a year.
Yeah, I think it's challenging because what you really want to do is take kids who are young for their grade, or who would be young for their grade if they matriculated into, let's say, kindergarten, and randomize some of them to staying behind versus going forward. In reality, that's not what happens. In reality, a parent makes a choice to hold them back. And so that choice is not random. And so it could be correlated with all sorts of other things that would be different about the child and their trajectory, because of the child or the investments or the way the parents might parent their kids. I think my take home is two things. One is that if your child is young for their grade, it's just something that you might want to have on your radar. You might have to invest more than you otherwise would invest. And the second thing is really more of a medical diagnostic point, which is that if you are, if your child, if there's a concern about ADHD in your child, what our study would say, and what we talk about in the book, is that maybe if your child is young for their grade, you want to pause and say, all right, maybe I can wait 6 months to a year before I take more advanced interventions to try to help my child. It's one thing to do sort of accommodations in school. It's another thing to say, let's start a child on a medication. For a child who's young for their grade, it may make sort of medical sense to give them a little bit of time to see if they catch up, as you might expect for a child who is just young for their grade.
That's great advice. Because those medications, they have side effects and consequences, some of which are not yet fully understood. So, to the extent you can avoid doing that's better, I would think. And you
Yeah.
also talked later on in the book, you look at opioid subscribing and cutoffs. And I thought that was just there's a chart there which just shows, low rates, and then this huge jump when a child passes their 18th birthday for rates of being prescribed opioids. And I thought that was another interesting cutoff example.
Yeah, it builds on this sort of general thing that we've been working on, which is try to understand why it is that doctors or other providers do what they do. The first thing that we found several years ago was that if you look in an emergency department, you will see that the probability that a person is prescribed an opioid, someone who's never been prescribed an opioid before, the probability that they receive an opioid in the emergency department depends heavily on who they happen to see. So, if you happen to see me, you might walk out with an opioid at a certain probability. If you see somebody else, you might walk out with an opioid at double that probability or half that probability. And that's just random. That's chance who you happen to see. So, that same principle we showed applies to something which is as arbitrary as a cutoff. So, when someone is 17 years old and 11 months, we think of them as a quote unquote child, right? But is there anything functioning medically, physiologically, between a kid who's 17 years old and 11 months and 18 years old and 2 weeks? No, there's no difference between them. But society now labels one an adult and one a child. And that has implications for all sorts of things that we do in life. Whether you can, for example, serve in the army would be a good example. Whether you can vote would be another good example. But in the hospital setting, there's no reason why you should prescribe differently at that cutoff. And yet we see that that happens. We see that in the same ED, by the same provider, when they see a 17.99-year-old versus an 18.1-year-old, the slightly older child is much more likely to prescribe an opioid. And we think it's because of a behavioral heuristic where you just view this person as a quote unquote adult. And so it's safer to prescribe opioids to quote unquote adults than it would be to children.
That is just fascinating. Well, and one of the big other themes through the book is this whole notion of, well, why do doctors do what they do? And the notion of correlating, what we're doing. Just for those of you who are just joining us, my guest is Bapu Jena, and we're talking about his terrific book, Random Acts of Medicine: How the Hidden Forces That Sway Doctors Impact Patients and Shape Our Lives. It's a truly interesting read, and it's this fascinating combination of economics and medicine, which I think is quite unique. So you talk also about marathons, and what I thought was interesting about that was this sort of chance comment that your wife made. She was running in a marathon, and you were hoping to watch her and cheer her on, and couldn't get parking because the roads next to the hospital were had been barricaded because of safety reasons relative to the marathon. And so your wife happens to say to you, "Well, gee, I wonder who else couldn't get to the hospital that day." And they got you started on this other really interesting study about, are marathons really bad for your health?
My wife is a source of a lot. I try to convince her to be a co-author with me, but she refuses. And I'm not sure why she says no, but you're exactly right. That was her comment. I don't think she realized that that could be a really interesting question. But as soon as she said that, I was like, yeah, I do wonder what happens to people who go to the hospital when there's a marathon. And we looked at it. We combined data from a bunch of years, a bunch of different cities, major cities that host marathons. And what you see is a few things. You see that on the day of a marathon, if you look at older Americans, the likelihood that they die if they've had a cardiac arrest or a heart attack, these are bad things for your heart, the likelihood that they die is greater if that happens to happen on a marathon day compared to any of the surrounding days of the week. So, for example, if a marathon happens in Chicago on Saturday, we observe a certain mortality rate for those patients, for those people. And it's lower on all the other Saturdays surrounding that, before and after. And there is no marathon day effect just outside of Chicago. Portions of the greater Chicago area that are not directly affected by the marathon. So it suggests that something is happening on the marathon day that is raising the mortality of older Americans. And the question is, what might that be? Could it be that they're running marathons? So someone who's 65 or 70 could absolutely be running a marathon. Now, the population that we're looking at, these aren't people who are running marathons. The average age is actually close to 80, and they have lots of chronic conditions. And if you look at people who have, let's say, dementia or who are on dialysis, a smaller group, you still see a very similar pattern. And those are not people who are running the marathon. So something is happening to them that increases their mortality that is not related to participation in the marathon. Next question is, maybe they're just being taken to different hospitals. So maybe the high quality hospital that has all the facilities that are able to address a cardiac emergency, those hospitals are less accessible on a marathon. That's the hypothesis. Well, we can look at that and we see that there's no difference in where people are taken on marathon days and non-marathon days. So it's not about where you go. Then the final puzzle is, well, maybe it's about how long it takes you to get there. So what we see is that people are taken to the same hospitals on marathon days and on non-marathon days, but it just takes them longer to get there. We had data from ambulance companies for a small set of these cities, and we can see that ambulance transport times, they go up somewhere between 20 and 30% on the mornings of those marathons when the roads are closed. But when the roads reopen, there's no more delays. And so this is a story about how delays in transportation because of road closures due to marathons have this, you know, pretty profound effect on mortality. The last thing I'll say, Rita, is that if people remember the Boston Marathon bombings, it's very salient. More people die because of road closures due to marathons in any given city in any given year than died in the Boston Marathon bombings. But this is something that's happening in the background. We're not thinking about it, but it's there.
So is there a policy recommendation or how do you sort of parse that?
So one recommendation is not to stop having marathons. That wouldn't be the recommendation. I think there's two things that come from a study. And I'll say, by the way, when I wanted to do that study, I wanted to do it because it was fun and interesting, and I wanted to know the answer. But I do think that there are still some things that are tangible take-home points from it. So I think the first is that if you're hosting a big event like a marathon, right now, what do municipalities do? What do? They think about the spectators. They think about the participants at the event. Maybe even the people who are watching or actually running in the event or performing, whatever it might be. What about all the other people who live in the nearby area? Those people aren't really thought about so much. And we know this because we talked to the emergency medical crews about how they deal with marathons. So the first policy prescription is, all right, keep in mind how might we access care for those individuals who need sort of life-threatening medical care, right? That's what they need. That's the first policy prescription. The second, I think, is more of a research or clinical question, which is the following. In our lives, one of the things that we have to grapple with the most when we are sick is how quickly do we need to do something? So if you're at home and your loved one is feeling short of breath, do you tell them to just sit down for a few minutes and see how they feel? Or do you say, we got to go to the emergency room right now? We go immediately. Or do you wait some hours? If you're an intern working in the hospital late at night and someone says to you that they have a headache, do you need to address that immediately? Can you wait 30 minutes? Can you wait 3 hours? These are all questions that we face. I mean, I've got two young kids. I think about this all the time. When do I need to make a call to the doctor? Yet there are no randomized trials that say 1,000 people are having chest pain, 500 of them go to the emergency room immediately, and the other 500 just hang out at home for a few hours and we'll see what happens. You would never do that trial. Here's a situation where nature gives us this experiment, this natural experiment where some people are by chance delayed in what they get care, and we can see that even minutes matter. So you could conduct the same sort of marathon analysis across a number of different medical conditions and really understand causally and quantitatively how much do minutes matter when it comes to this medical condition or that medical condition, so forth.
That's a huge point. And you know, sort of, I guess a little bit related to the marathon chapter is one called "What Happens When All the Cardiologists Leave Town?" And you're talking there about big medical conventions. And what that means is that the patients being seen when their primary cardiologist or the more experienced cardiologists are all off connecting with each other and looking at the latest technologies and one thing and another, which is all good, right? But it means that those patients are often left with people who are less familiar with them, less familiar with their conditions, or less familiar, in fact, with the whole, experience of the hospital. And I thought that was a very interesting naturally occurring experiment as well.
Yeah, the question is it a good experiment or a bad experiment? Because when I had this idea, I was thinking to myself, okay, patients in the hospital might do worse. And the reason why is because, maybe the staffing is lower. Maybe the types of cardiologists who remain behind in the hospital are different than the ones who go to these major cardiology meetings. And if the people who are attending those meetings are the more senior faculty, the more senior cardiologists, maybe outcomes would get worse during the dates of those meetings because they're just not around in the hospital. And when we looked at the data, we actually found the opposite. We found that if you happen to have a cardiac arrest, let's start with that condition, on the days of the American Heart Association or American Cardiology meetings, your mortality is actually lower, meaning you do better if that happens to happen during the date of these meetings versus in the surrounding weeks. And the question is, like, how could that be true? How could it be the case that when cardiologists are away, you do better? And what we show is that rates of certain procedures fall. They fall by about a third. So I think what's going on is that the procedural intensity, so how aggressive we are in terms of the procedures that we're offering to patients, that falls during the dates of the meetings, A, because the operators of those procedures aren't there, or B, like you alluded to, because there might just not be as much backup or familiarity and, a desire to say, well, look, maybe this person doesn't need this procedure. And ultimately, the question is that a good thing or a bad thing for patients? Because we do procedures because we think that they help. And here we find that when we withdraw the use of some procedures, at least by some amount, that patients actually do better. And that sort of opens up a whole can of worms as to why that might be the case, that in this instance, less might be more when it comes to medical care.
That's so counterintuitive, right? Because I would agree with you. You would think if all the experienced people got up and left, that the care would be worse. But interesting. So it does raise the question of, we have in many of these medical situations, we have a real bias to take action of some kind, and yet sometimes you're better off not intervening, which is always, a big issue. I'm sure you have patients all the time that, beg you to do something when maybe in your own judgment, this is something maybe better be left for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a good example. My mom was, she's a little bit over 80, and about a week and a half ago, we were talking, and she said that one of their family friends who had they had just spent some time with called her and my dad and said that they had just been they just tested positive for COVID. And when they were hanging out the day before, that person had, some kind of like mild flu-like symptoms, but was generally feeling well enough. And so my mom calls me and says, what should I do? I said, well, right now you don't do anything. You just wait to see what happens, if anything. And she'd gotten all these vaccines and boosters and things like that. And so she was pretty well protected. Then 3 days later, she says, I've got a cough and a really low grade fever, almost 100, not technically a fever, but high enough. And so she asked me what she should do. And she has some pulmonary problems. And I thought, well, maybe it's not a bad idea to take Paxlovid, just because she's older, she's at higher risk of problems, but at the same time, she's actually feeling pretty well. And ultimately, we ended up deciding with her PCP, we'll just wait and see what happens because she was feeling generally pretty well. And she got better over the course of a couple of days pretty rapidly. But there was a situation where the evidence might say, on average, people like her should be given Paxlovid. But the evidence doesn't give you specific prescriptions for a particular person. So we don't know, like, if her symptoms aren't that bad, she's doing her normal activities, she's walking up and down the street, walking up and down the hill, her temperature's not that elevated, she doesn't feel like crap, but she does have COVID, what do we do? And so there's where I think judgment comes into play, and sometimes less might be a better approach.
Very interesting. And you have a wonderful chapter which tries to unpack the question of what makes a good doctor. You know, what factors come into it. And you look at things like their gender and their age and their years of experience and their training. and you know, each of these things has an effect, but it's kind of hard to put them all together in one.
Well, I teach at Harvard Medical School. What they tell me is that Harvard makes a good doctor. I'm not 100% sure about that, but we have done some work on that. But it's an interesting question. So I'll just give you sort of a thought experiment. Imagine that you are walking into a room and you're seeing a physician for the first time, and they look really young, because they are young. Is that reassuring to you, or is that scary to you? To some people, it might feel scary because they're like, whoa, how young is this person? Do they have enough experience to know what to do here? I think it's a very reasonable thing to ask. And I'm certainly would fall victim to that as well when I'm making recommendations to friends and family about who to see. I'm not typically thinking, let me find the absolute youngest person out there, right? But if you look at the data, and I use data very specifically here, if you look at patients who are admitted to the hospital and treated by a younger physician who's just a few years out of their residency training, or an older physician who might be, let's say, 20 years out of their residency training. And these are both physicians who focus on hospital-based care. That's all they do. A few things are true. One is that patients are kind of, they're randomized to these doctors by nature. You don't go to the hospital on Monday night thinking, I'm going to get the 35-year-old doctor, but if I go on Thursday, I'm going to get the 55-year-old or 60-year-old doctor. That you don't think that, you don't know that. So that's random who you happen to get exposed to as a patient. The second thing that we find is that in this particular setting, which is a common one, general medical care that happens in the hospital, the younger your doctor is, the better your outcomes are, the more likely you are to survive that hospitalization. And that might feel weird. Why would that be true? Because the older doctors are, the more experienced they get. They see more cases. They know more about the illnesses that affect humans. So why would that be true? And what we think is going on is that there's a trade-off between experience. So the older you are, you get more experience, but also sort of just being more familiar with the most up-to-date medical care. So in residency, these doctors are working 80 hours a week easily. And they're learning everything that is new about medicine at that point in time, not what was new 15 years ago. That's what they're learning at that moment. And so when they come out, they're pretty sophisticated and up to date on the most recent medical thinking, both diagnosis and treatment. And so that seems to offset the fact that they have a little bit, or they have substantively less experience, years of experience, than older docs. The other thing that I'd say is that if you look at older docs who have who are still pretty active, they see a lot of patients, they seem to be preserved. So even though they are further away from that very intense period of knowledge acquisition that happens in residency, they still do quite well. And it's probably because they're seeing a lot of patients. So they're acquiring those skills, they're reading up on things a lot. The challenge is if someone is older and their volume, the number of patients that they see, is lower, that's when we think that problems might arise.
Which is, as a doctor friend of mine once said, if you have big problems, you want to go to big places where there's a lot really going on. Interesting. And you also talk about the a young doctor who studied television doctors, which I would have loved to do that. And he coined something called the Marcus Welby effect.
I mean, there's, by the way, I mean, we talk about a lot of interesting studies, and this person was looking at sort of how the evolution of doctors has changed as portrayed on TV over time, and they look very different, right? There was the Marcus Welby doctor years ago. Now the doctors are, pretty hip, and they're cracking a lot of jokes in the TV shows. I will say one study that we have wanted to do, Rita, that we have not done yet, is I'm curious to see whether or not doctors with British accents or English accents are perceived to be smarter and more reliable and trustworthy than other doctors. I have that feeling. And when I'm in the hospital and I'm talking to a colleague, I haven't met them before. If they've got a British accent, I almost have to believe everything that they say. Maybe it's the same for patients. I don't know.
That's really funny. So another kind of story in the book is about the day that Ronald Reagan got, well, there was an assassination attempt, and lots of drama, lots of whatever. And then before he goes under the anesthetic, he asks the question, "You're all Republicans, right?" to the team that's around him at the operating table. And I thought, A, how extraordinary they had his wits about him to be able to make a wisecrack in that very, tense moment. But I thought the response was great, which was, "We're all Republicans today,
Yeah,
Mr. President."
it's all. I guess it's almost hard to believe that someone could come up with that quick and witty a response. It's like almost like they were a writer for the West Wing or something. But yeah, you hear that, you're like, wow, that's a great response. I don't know that I would have come up with that at the moment, but I'm glad someone did because it was a great intro into a chapter in our book where we talk about politics and medicine. And certainly with the COVID pandemic and issues that we're seeing now around reproductive care, there's no question that politics sort of infiltrates a lot of what we do and think about in healthcare policy, and even in medicine. And one question that we had been interested in is whether or not the politics of a doctor could influence the care that they provide. And it's not crazy to think that. There's, for example, if you think about the HPV vaccine, human papillomavirus, it causes cervical cancer, and there's a vaccine against that. Now, there is sometimes connotations around whether or not it's appropriate to give that vaccine to a young girl because might it put ideas into their mind? People think that. I don't think that, but it's a reasonable question to wonder whether or not politics enters into the bedside of a physician in these kind of highly politically charged areas. One area that we focused on was looking at end-of-life care, under the idea that if your view is that end-of-life care or life is sacred, you might want to do everything that you can do to prolong life. And we look to see whether or not Republican doctors are more aggressive at the end of life in the care that they provide than, let's say, Democrat doctors. And we identify that information by linking doctors to political donation data, which is publicly available. And the long story short is that we don't find any effect there. We find that if you are hospitalized and you end up dying in the hospital, that the intensity of care that you receive as a patient is really unaffected by the political leanings of your doctor. That's not to say that politics of a doctor doesn't come into other places. For example, there is some evidence that it affected COVID-19 treatments and which treatments were offered to people. But by and large, at least in this important domain, we don't find much.
So really interesting. And so since the book came out, it's been out a few months now, I think.
July.
Yeah, okay. Have there been any surprises in the reactions that you've been getting?
I'm getting some good ideas. People send, yeah, people send, what we wanted to do with the book was, we wanted it to be A, approachable to people,
Which it
but
is, it's incredibly
it is
cool.
approachable, yeah. And there's an undercurrent in the book, which we kind of highlight a little bit more towards the end, but there's an undercurrent, which is that in life, whatever your occupation is, let's say you're a computer scientist or you're a transplant surgeon, whatever it is, you are taught the tools to solve problems. A computer scientist is taught the tools of computer science to solve a problem that a computer scientist would be asked to solve. A transplant surgeon is taught the surgical techniques to transplant one organ into another person's body, right? We're taught those problems, taught those tools. But we're not taught of how to sort of conceive of the most interesting of problems. We're taught how to solve problems. And so this book is really about walking readers in part through this creative exercise of where do these ideas come from? How do we come up with them? And at the end, what we tell readers is, what we do, what Chris Worsham and I, who's my co-author, what we do is we sit down probably 2 to 3 hours per week with others and we just brainstorm ideas. We come up with ideas, most of them are not good, and that's fine, because all that matters is that some of them are good. Some of them are interesting enough and doable to make it into an interesting study. So that is one sort of takeaway from the book that I hope people gather, which is, think about how to become more creative, because I don't think that it's just something that people are born with. These are people who are innately creative versus not. In the same that same way we can teach someone how to transplant an organ from one human being to another, I would think that we can teach people how to kind of tap into their own creativity.
So there's a previous guest on my fireside and a person who's a lecturer at the Stanford Design School, Jeremy Utley, who wrote a great book called Idea Flow. And this book is just full of very specific exercise and ideas. And among the things he says, which are kind of relevant to the problems you've been studying, is you want to keep going after you got the first satisfactory idea. So, you don't just settle on the first thing that seems to work. You want to go to the sixth or seventh or eighth or ninth alternative, because very often those are far more rich and creative than the first thing that, kind of would do the job. And I thought that was very profound, because I think for most of us, we're busy, our minds are stretched, and we're anxious to move on to the next thing, right? And so the first thing that kind of works, we pick up. But he would argue against that. And I think what you're talking about here is something very similar.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is a question that comes up a lot when we're thinking about what kind of research project to do. I'm always sort of balancing how creative is the idea, how difficult would it be to implement, how important would the findings be if we find something that is interesting. And of course, the best research questions, the best questions in general, are ones where it doesn't matter what you find, the answer would be important. Those are sort of harder to find. Then there's a next level of questions, which are, if you find this could be really interesting. Like, for example, in the ADHD birth month paper, if we found that there was no relationship between birth month and ADHD, I don't know that it would have been an interesting paper. It would have been an interesting exercise to go into this and think about the question, but the finding is sort of interesting because it's a positive finding. And so we kind of struggle with that question of how do we balance these types of questions and how long it takes to implement them. So it's sort of a practical challenge that we face in research.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Safi Bakal talks about a lot, who's he's also a doctor and an ex-physicist. He founded a biotech firm, and he wrote this great book called Loonshots. And he said the trouble is that these new ideas that fly in the face of conventional wisdom, often at first are seen by the incumbent people as just being crazy or not possible or just not practical, and so they get ignored or shoved into the sidelines. And I've often wondered in medicine how I've got to think there are many potential cures that, or potential treatments, or potential things that we've just discarded because they seem so crazy, right?
I think that's right. I mean, the COVID-19 example, there's a long history behind the development of the COVID vaccine and hurdles that were faced because there's a question of whether or not this was a technology that was A, feasible, and B, really clinically applicable. And we learned ultimately that it was in this very important setting and probably will continue to be in other diseases and also not in just in a vaccination context. But we in medicine, I think we struggle with this because we almost have these two. There's this hierarchy where we have randomized controlled trials. We're lucky to have that in medicine, where in economics, for example, it's not as common to see randomized controlled trials. We see that, but not nearly as common as in medicine, in part because I think the stakes are very high. Like, you don't want to have people in a large population take a drug that you're not absolutely convinced will work, and so federal regulations require that we produce that information for drug approval or device approval. That makes a lot of sense. But then we have all these other studies in medicine, which I think are arguably, not arguably, but they're much, much, much lower quality. And nonetheless, we sort of hear about them in the news. They often shape the way we think. I'm thinking about the relationship between red wine or chocolate or this particular diet and some health outcome. These studies are not experimental in any way. They're just correlational. And so those kinds of studies, they're endemic in medicine. And part of what I've been trying to do, and people that I work with say, we kind of have to stop doing those things. Not every question that we would want to ask can be asked or should be asked if you're not going to use good quality methods to do that. So we've been pushing this idea of natural experiments, trying to find these situations where we are exposed by chance to something else, whether it's a diet, whether it's an exercise regimen, whether it's a wireless, an app, whatever it might be, or a medication to see what works and doesn't work, because ultimately that's what we care about.
So, you're raising this makes me think of the, I guess I'll call it the hype cycle in medicine, where certain things will become really popular, and then I would imagine you as a physician get pressured into responding to that in some way, even if you don't think it's a great idea. But I'm reminded to just I think it was just this morning that Oprah Winfrey has announced she's standing down from the board of Weight Watchers. And of course, Weight Watchers, or WWs, they rebranded themselves now. Their whole claim to fame is we're going to help you manage your weight using, controlled portions and special substances, these meetings and this whole program, right, of behavioral influence. And here's Oprah, who, of all people, is probably one of the best known people to struggle with weight, has just said, no, I'm going with medication. And I just think that whole transition is absolutely fascinating. And I wonder, weight loss and other conditions that we sort of attribute to lack of willpower, being addicted to certain substances and being overweight and all these things. And we sort of have a moral wrapper around them, right? Which is, oh, if you're overweight, you eat too much or you eat the wrong foods, or we sort of blame the victim. And I think what this whole new chapter of medication-enabled weight loss is beginning to show us is that the relationships are so much more complicated than we, I guess, had previously thought.
Yeah, I would agree. I think one thing that we don't appreciate as much as we need to in medicine is that behavior change is, really, really hard. So, if we see somebody, and if I see somebody in the clinic, and I want to talk to them about diet and exercise, of course I'll talk to them about that. But is it really the case that someone doesn't know that if they change their diet or they exercise more, that they couldn't be healthier? I mean, of course they know that. That's not the problem. The problem is not the knowledge. The problem is the implementation because it's so difficult. One way to look at this, and actually we've done this, is let's look at the health behaviors of doctors and compare them to the general population.
Oh,
If you
that's
look at
interesting.
doctors, they don't do that much better. You know, they, you know, we we've looked at how often doctors vaccinate their kids and other healthy behaviors, rates of hypertension, diabetes, things like that. They tend to be better, but they're not zero, or they're not 100%. They're not optimal. And so what it tells you is that it is just very difficult. One area that I give a lot of thought to, we were talking about end of life care earlier. In the hospital, we will often see people who are at the end of life, and it's a very difficult thing to advise a family what to do in that setting, how long to push, because it's uncertain. And there's, I think, a common refrain among physicians that we should pull back care earlier, because if the care is futile, then it's harmful, it's costly, and it's unlikely to improve survival. So why would you want to do it? Which makes sense. The challenge is if you look at doctors and you look at their own end of life care decisions, they are very similar to the general public. So this is not an issue of just not knowing. This is not an issue of doctors knowing how end of care looks like and no one else knowing what end of care looks like. People understand it, they live it, and when you're in that moment, you understand it. But it's very difficult to make those kinds of decisions about how hard to push, when to pull back. And that's a human problem. That's not just a knowledge problem.
Well, and that was something that I think you've touched on with great humility throughout the book, which is, doctors can be wrong. Doctors can make mistakes. You use the illustration of confusing two sort of similar patients who are in the same room, and getting their treatment sort of swapped.
Yeah.
And I mean, of course, doctors are people too. And I think that is another theme that I thought was handled with great sort of humanity and humility throughout the book.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I think one thing now I've sort of learned more. I didn't appreciate this until I had kids, and my parents are older now, is that the phrase two eyes are better than one, or two heads are better than one, or two heads are better than one, not two eyes. Two eyes are better than one for sure. But the idea that when a doctor and a patient are in a therapeutic relationship, it's not just top down. It's not just what the doctor says. The doctor makes a diagnosis. The doctor offers recommendations for treatment. It really is a bilateral situation there. And I think it's really important for patients to ask questions when they're unclear about what something means, or when their preferences might depart from what the doctor might think that their preferences are. And I think we see too little of that happen. I wish we would see more, and it's useful to think about how to get more of that sort of engagement in medicine. Part of it, I think, is just time, Rita. You know, when you have a typical patient encounter, you can't have an in-depth conversation if you're in and out in 10 minutes. It's just not going to happen. Can't have an in-depth conversation with an electrician in 10 minutes. So how could you have one with your medical provider? I think time is probably an important part of the solution, but there's other things that might matter as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've been studying, and there's a great book by Paul LeBlanc called Broken, and he's looking at systems of care, as he calls them. So, higher education, medicine, the penal system, addiction treatment. And his conclusion is that to scale these systems, it's almost like you need a human point of interaction. And so he uses the example in medicine of One Medical, I think it's called, where the more skilled, experienced clinicians spend relatively little time with the patients, but then they have almost like a care navigator, who's typically a person who's not as expensive, but who, for example, let's say you advise diet and exercise or lowering the salt in their diet. You might make that prescription, and then this helper person would actually sit with the patient for an hour if it's necessary and say, okay, let's look at what that actually looks like. What do you buy on a typical trip to the grocery store? How often do you get to the gym? And I'm very intrigued by that because one of the problems with systems that are built at scale is it's very hard to tailor them to human quirks. And so this notion that somehow maybe in healthcare what we need is the two eyes, right? So you've got the clinician, but you've also perhaps got these other people that have the time to be more connected to what the patients are really looking at. I mean, I'd be very intrigued to see if that way of thinking might be picked up more. And there's a company that I'm also really interested in. They're called CareBridge, and I don't know if you know of them, but they do at home and community care for kind of people that are very ill who are on Medicare or Medicaid. And what they've been able to do is really surround these people with 24/7 care. And their thesis is if I can prevent someone from having a fall or breaking a hip or picking up an infection, and I can avoid a hospitalization down the road, and I get paid not on a per service basis, but I get paid on a capitation basis, that might work economically. And so far, it seems to be bearing fruit. They seem to be making it work, which is fascinating to me.
It's interesting, yeah. You know, one theme we talk about in the book and is sort of the role of rigorous evaluation. And there's a lot of interest in different types of care models. And that's one type of care model. But it reminds me of this study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago. It was about the Camden Coalition. And the Camden Coalition, Jeffrey Brenner started it along with other people, and it was a highly intensive care management program for people who are hospitalized and who are at risk of being rehospitalized. So they threw, you know, the kitchen sink at the problem, social work, all sorts of wraparound services to try to keep these individuals from going back to the hospital. And there was some initial evidence that they had produced that looked like it might work, but when they subjected it to a randomized controlled trial, which was a really important thing that they did, they didn't have to do that, but they partnered with researchers to do that. And in a randomized trial, they found that they actually didn't do any better than the standard of care services. And so it was an important reminder to us that what we think might work, what seems like it would have to work, may not always work. And so as I think about new payment models, new delivery models, care models, I'm thinking about the evaluation being an important component of that and to be done in a rigorous way.
Absolutely. So that time has just flown. Before I let you go, how do people learn more? They can obviously pick up this terrific book, Random Acts of Medicine, which is a really approachable and fun read. What else should they look to?
First look to the skies. No, I don't know. I'd say three things. So first is the book. It's a fun book. We put a lot of time and effort and thought into it, and I think it reflects the way that Chris and I think about our lives and the world, and I think it's fun. The second is, as you mentioned earlier, Freakonomics MD is a podcast. It has very similar types of themes. And the last thing is, Chris and I have a Substack or a newsletter called Random Acts of Medicine, same title as the book, where we try to kind of continue on some of these themes of looking at different interesting studies in medicine, different ideas, some of which we actually do ourselves. You know, we might have an interesting finding and say, all right, well, we don't want to write it up for a scientific journal. We just want to let you know what we're finding. So it's a really fun read, and it's short every week.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much for spending the time with us and for writing this great book. And to be continued, I hope.
Thank
Thanks.
you. I appreciate it.